Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, I'll be speaking with Goldilocks. She was on KVC Arts a few years ago talking about her music, and now we'll hear about how she's had to adapt as a performing musician during the coronavirus pandemic. Now, we'll also be hearing some behind-the-scenes talk in the world of wrestling, another side to Goldilocks, hearing about the various roles people play, not just the wrestlers, but also the managers, the ref, the writers, and more. Also, just what does it really mean for a person to be a championship belt holder in the world of sports entertainment, which in matches has a predetermined outcome? Tonight, we'll also hear from actress Donna Mills. We'll hear about her acting career, her shoulder pads, and more. Here's KVZR's Lillian Vasquez.
You have performed on stage, in movies, television, and early in your career working in soap operas. Of course, one of your most famous roles was the conniving Abby Fairgate Cunningham Ewing Sumner on the nighttime series Knots Landing.
Very good with the names there.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I was getting my second degree in college, and I used to book my classes in the evening so that I didn't miss it. I would take a 4 to 6 class and get home in time so I could watch, because this was before recording stuff on your DVRs and stuff like that. Let's talk about Knots Landing. Can we talk about the character in the series for a bit? She was wicked, and I read you enjoyed playing this horrible character. Why?
Oh, she wasn't horrible.
She was vicious and mean and conniving and ruthless, but we loved to hate her.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was really fun to play. First of all, the writing was very good, so it was easy to play because when the writing's good, it just kind of flows. And she was. She was manipulative and conniving, and you never could turn your back on her and stuff like that. But because the writing was so good and because they were so good at creating characters, they didn't make her one-dimensional. She wasn't just evil. She wasn't just calculating. She had vulnerabilities. She had children that she loved.
Right.
And the thing about the character that I love, too, is whenever you saw those vulnerabilities, she was by herself. So you as the audience could see her by herself, but
Right.
nobody else, none of the other characters saw her.
Right.
So they all thought that she was just this one level. But you as the audience got to know her better and got to see her cry, got to see her be flummoxed, but she never showed that to anyone else. Only the audience got to see that. And I thought that was brilliant of the writers to do that and make her three-dimensional. That's the reason you were able to love her as well as hate her.
Right. And when you would see those moments, you would go, okay, she does have a heart. She does have compassion. She's nice to Olivia or what the other kid's name, I don't remember. And then for a second, I think, can I give her a chance? No, then they'd come right back. And you just like, ah. So I want to ask you, were there particular actors or scenes or people you liked were, I mean, it's a full cast, but were there some more memorable scenes? Like I specifically enjoyed when you had scenes with William Devane, because I thought he could hold his own to you, whereas Gary Ewing, yeah. Ted Shackelford, just couldn't.
Yeah, I know. You know, I love working with them both for, you know, different reasons.
Sure.
But Bill is like, in my estimation, a major actor. And he just was so much fun to work with because you never knew what he was going to do. I mean, he would come up with the most bizarre things and staging and all that. It was really, really fun to kind of keep up with that and stay on that level. And his character was fun, too, because he was another guy who was conniving and evil sometimes and all that. So it was a nice counterpoint for us.
Yeah, I think he gave you a run for your money. Of course, you held your own, but I liked it when someone was finally a little stronger, or even you'd see sparkles of, okay, he's going to get her. But were you close with the cast? I'm sure you love them all, but were you specifically close with any of the characters in Knots Landing, or do you maybe remain friends today?
Well, yeah, it's funny. Joan Van Ark and Michelle Lee and I just did an evening with, it's called, in Palm Springs. You know, at a place called Oscars, which is kind of a nightclub,
yes.
restaurant mm-hmm. place. And we, you know, we're just on stage with a moderator. Sandy Newton moderated it. And it was lovely. And just asking questions, showing video. It was fans. It was people who knew the storylines on Knot Landing better than we did.
I'm sure.
But it was fun for them to see the characters together. And we have all remained friends all these years. Mm. And we have this funny rapport together. I mean, we each are very individual, but we're funny together.
Nice.
So it was really fun. It was the first one like that that we've done, but they're talking about doing more of those evenings with, and I hope we do. They're talking about London, and that would be really fun.
Well, I would love to attend one. London's a little far, but if you know of one that's going to be a little closer, I'd love to be there. That's terrific. Do you think okay. shoulder pads will ever make their way back?
Oh, I hope so. I really hope so. Although, you know, I kept a lot of those clothes. And I go to put them on now, even though shoulder pads came back a little bit.
For a second.
You know, in the last couple of years. I go someplace and buy a blouse, and there was a shoulder pad sewn in. I go, yes, they're coming back. But they didn't come back to the extent that they were then. And I take some of those clothes out now, and I put them on, and I go, oh, no, no, I can't. They looked great. When I look back at scenes in the show and stuff like that, the clothes were magnificent. But they look kind of silly now.
I know, but they were still magnificent. They were just, you know, the way they shaped your body and how, yeah, I love shoulder pads, and I was hoping they would make a comeback.
Me too. I think it has to do with a strength in a woman. Do you know what I mean? They make you look stronger. They make you look taller and better and bigger and that,
yeah.
you know, all that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they will. Probably. It seems like everything comes back around to some extent.
Exactly. So I want to ask you, in the 80s, I remember you did this instructional video about makeup. And let's mm-hmm. face it, your eyes are one of your greatest beautiful assets. Did you know makeup, or did you learn it by sitting in the chair?
I pretty much learned it by sitting in the chair. Mm. And by sitting in the chair, mostly for makeup artists from magazines and stuff like that, because I did a lot of covers and a lot of New York fashion kind of things. And those makeup artists were spectacular. I loved them, and I watched everything that they did. Hmm. The makeup artists on the set in Los Angeles for television and stuff like that, they were good, but they didn't have the flair. They were supposed to make people look real, you
sure.
know, normal. The makeup artists from New York and in the fashion world were supposed to make you look exciting and glamorous.
Right.
And that's what I loved, and that's what I went for. So that's why I started doing my own makeup on the show and on every show that I did, because the makeup artists in the film industry just didn't know how to do that as well. And it saved time.
And it allowed you to for your eyes to pop. That's what was your greatest, I mean,
yeah.
your cheekbones and everything else, but your eyes were always smoldering and just gorgeous. And then being so blue, yeah. they just popped.
Yeah, thank you. Mm. Thank you.
You've done a lot of projects over the years. Were some more special to you? And then not just Knot's Landing, but some that you either produced or were involved with for one reason or another.
Yeah, you know, when I left, I did a couple of movies for television that I produced before I left Knot,
mm.
but it was hard to do because we didn't have that much time off.
Mm.
So that made, you know, a real crunch for me as far as time and that. But once I left, I started developing a number of projects that I'd been thinking about for a long time.
Mm.
One of them was Runaway Father, which was about a deadbeat dad,
mm.
true story from a book that I bought. Then there was one called My Name is Kate,
right.
about a woman who's an alcoholic. And I did The World's Oldest Living Bridesmaid, which I loved. It wasn't
yeah.
kind of a message movie. It was just a fun movie.
Sure.
I did a lot of movies that I wanted to tell a particular story. You know, I'd gotten to a place where I could tell the network what I wanted to do.
Sure.
And they would buy it. You don't get in that position very often. So I wanted to take advantage of one of the reasons I left Knot's when I did, because I wanted to do these other movies.
They were probably pretty sad when, I mean, it was a whole company, but your character obviously rose to the top. So you leaving left a void there. They carried on, of course, but it definitely left a void not having Abby there to foil everything.
By that time, the show had been on the air 10 years.
Right.
I came on the second year. And I felt like the writers were kind of like going, oh, I don't know what to do with Abby now. You know, what are we going to do? And I really didn't want her storylines and character to kind of go downhill. I wanted to get off the ship while...
Sure. You wanted to go off while it was on top and your character was still strong. Yeah. They were trying to make her a little softer towards the end and a little nicer. And that's not who she was, I don't think.
No, no. And I kept telling them that, but, you know, they don't always listen. But it was good. It was a very, you know, amicable parting. David Jacobs, who is the main creator and producer, is a wonderful man who I'm very friendly with to this day, too. And he said, you know, I understand. Because I said to him, don't start making me all kinds of offers of lots of money and blah, blah, blah. I want to leave. This is not a ploy to get more from you. Don't do that to me because that'll be agony for me. He said, okay, I won't. Just know that if you want to come back, just call me.
Which is why I'm glad they didn't kill your character.
Right.
So that had the option. I'm speaking with actress and producer Donna Mills. Donna, I read that you had performed recently, a couple years back, on stage in the production of Driving Miss Daisy, which is not a sexy role. It's not a vixen role. Did you enjoy this character and what she brings to the stage in that storyline?
I did. I really, really did. You know, when they called me and somebody called me and said, you wouldn't want to do Driving Miss Daisy, would you? And I went, well, let me think about that. Maybe I would. And I ended up saying, yes, I do want to do this. I wanted to do it because I hadn't done anything on the stage in a long time, and I wanted to see if I could still do it. Mm-hmm. It's probably the hardest acting mode there is.
Without a doubt.
And I really wanted to see if I could, I don't know if this will make any sense, live in the character on stage.
Yeah.
And I accomplished that, and it was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. It's a wonderful character, and I think many times it's been played just that she's kind of acerbic and crabby and, you know, not very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I really tried to find her heart, find what she was really about, and I think I did, and it was a wonderful experience. I would love to do it again.
Hmm. And who played your driver?
Arthur Richardson is his name. He hasn't done a whole lot. He's done Driving Miss Daisy before. He's quite good. And James Leo Ryan played my son, and he was wonderful. We're good friends to this day. And it was just, you know, it's three people on stage the entire time.
Right.
So
it's a lot.
It is. It's a heavy load, but it was very, very rewarding for me. I really liked doing it.
Well, I hope you get the opportunity to do it again.
That's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Donna Mills, actor, producer, and more. We'll have more with Mills just ahead and later Goldilocks. We've had her on the program in the past talking about her music, and now we'll be hearing about how she's had to adapt during the coronavirus pandemic. She also gives us a glimpse behind the scenes in the world of wrestling entertainment. Let's go now, though, back to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Donna Mills. In the 70s, so many shows you might have caught her on: Quincy, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, The $6 Million Man, Hawaii Five-O, and so many more. In the 80s, you'd know her mainly as the conniving Abby on Knots Landing.
What advice would you give your younger self looking back, or did you do everything the way you wanted?
Oh, God, no. Never made a mistake. No, I don't know if I would do anything different because, you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly hasn't been bad for me. It's been really good. I might have studied more.
Hmm.
You know, I did study when I was in New York. I was taking acting class while I was doing the soap opera. That was a wonderful way to kind of use the things you're learning as you're working, which is hard to do in this business. I don't know. I might have had a child earlier, maybe. Although I must say that whatever wisdom you gain as you get older, I think helped in being a mother.
Well, that segues me perfectly into my next thought is you have a daughter, Chloe.
Mm-hmm.
You adopted your daughter after Knots Landing. What advice do you offer her?
She's a model. And she's done really well. She was in New York. She's back out here now, kind of redoing her career. But what I've always told her, and which is a model that she lives by, is that, you know, you just have to keep doing it. You're going to get knocked down 100 times.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. You just have to get back up again and do it. Very hard not to let it bruise your ego, not to let it hurt you so much that you can't go on. this business can be cruel. The modeling business can be even crueler. And she's got great fortitude and takes the punches and is doing really well. I think she's learned that lesson.
Well, way to go, Mom.
Thank you.
Over the years, you've worked with a lot of people, from Bob Hope to Clint Eastwood. Anyone that you didn't get to work with, or is there someone that you really enjoyed working with and you'd love to work with them again?
There's so many that I'd like to work with. You know who
really?
I worked with? And you may not even know this, and I didn't work with him, but when I did Joy, David O. Russell, you know, we did that sequence that was supposed to be in a soap opera. He was amazing to work with, David. Mm. But we worked with Robert De Niro.
Oh.
We were in the scene together. We like didn't speak to each other in the scene, but I would just love to actually work with him, actually do scenes with him. And he was amazingly nice, just kind of very unassuming and not like I'm a big star. He was lovely. And I would really like to work with him. I mean, there's lots of people that I'd love to work with. Meryl Streep, come on. Helen Mirren. Mm. You know, there's lots of people that I would love to work with.
All strong women characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Since America Television is all over the world, are you most recognized for your role as Abby? And in what countries have you been recognized as Abby or other characters? Where have you been where you go, okay, this is odd that they know me here?
I mean, there are many countries. France is huge on Knots Landing.
Oh, really?
I mean, yeah, they loved it. But the place that surprised me, I was asked, this is back in probably the 90s, to go to the Cairo Film Festival to be the guest of honor. Yeah. And I said, but I do television. You know, why do they want me? They said, you're big over here. You're really big over here. Oh, okay. So I went. And they were going to have a press conference. And I thought, there'll probably be, you know, 2-3 journalists there. And I walked into the room. There were 200 journalists from all over the Arab world.
Oh, my.
And, I mean, they were fans. They were huge fans. Everywhere that I went in Cairo, people recognized me. So that was really surprising to me. I had no idea. And that was a Knots Landing that they loved. I had no idea it was that big in those countries. It was really fun. I, however, made the police there crazy because I, like, went out into the market by myself, and they had this, like, armed guards for me and everything like that. And I was, like, wandering around by myself. Hi, how are you? And, oh, my God. I mean, the people were lovely. Couldn't have been nicer.
Wow, that's wonderful.
But the police didn't like that.
Didn't care for you too much. I remember I saw you, I think it was at the Pantages Theater. I think it was Lion King. You were standing next to me in line and, you know, I didn't want to look and make you feel odd. You know, I don't know if you're with your family or who you're with. I'm like, okay, but oh my God, her eyes are gorgeous.
Thank you.
You know, the business has changed a lot. Do you think it's easier now or tougher now?
I think it's tougher now.
Really?
I do. There's more work. Probably because there's so many shows being done, but people come and go so fast. Mm. I mean, somebody can be on a series and be on it for a number of years, and they're still not a household name.
There's so many avenues now. It's not just ABC, NBC, and CBS like it was back in the day.
Right. Because when I was doing Knots, we would get 70, 80 million viewers.
Wow.
Now, nothing gets that many viewers.
Right.
They're happy if they get 2 million viewers.
Isn't that amazing?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's very different. The actors who are on big shows right now, maybe Game of Thrones, maybe there's a few shows,
right.
But most of the shows, the actors really aren't very well known. It's so spread out now.
Right.
There's so many different places to go. And they don't have the huge viewership that they used to have of a particular show.
Yeah,
you know, like I said, nobody gets 80 million viewers anymore.
Only the
happen.
Super Bowl. I think the Super Bowl gets, and it's only once a year.
Yeah, exactly. But none of these shows get that. None of the, you know, drama shows or anything like that. Even if they're big, like This Is Us, you know?
Right, yeah.
And that's a network show. So it gets more than the cable shows, but still not anywhere near what they used to get.
Right. Things have definitely changed. What causes are important to you? What are you passionate about outside of acting and producing?
Well, I've been an environmentalist back when it used to be a dirty word, you know? She's an environmentalist. Oh, my God. And so I've been on that bandwagon for a very long time, putting different groups together to work together. I've been very active in something called ECHO, which was Earth Communications Office, which got all the studios to start recycling and being aware. And many, many organizations, Environment California, Environment America, there's lots of them. And also always supporting politicians who were environmentally knowledgeable.
Right.
And, you know, now it's come to a critical point. I've been saying that for years and years and years. It's getting to a critical point. People listen. And now finally it's come to that. And so I think more people are listening, but still
have a ways to go. Right.
Yep.
And lastly, what would you like to do at this point in your career? What projects really interest you? What's next on your plate?
I don't know what's next. I've been doing all these little independent movies. It's really weird. I somehow became the queen of the small independent movie. I mean, I've done like five of them in the last year and a half, which is great. I would love to do a series again, though.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What would that be? What kind of series would it be that would spark your interest to do that again?
You know, it could be a comedy. I'd love to do a comedy. I started out doing comedy. The first series that I did here was a series with Larry Hagman called The Good Life.
I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would love to do that. So I'm auditioning for things. And these days I have to go and audition. I mean, these little independent movies, they just
send scripts
to me. But
right.
You know, other things, they don't. I have to go and audition. So, you know, we'll see what happens. You just keep going in this business. Like I said, you just keep doing it.
Well, I hope to turn on my television and see you on a new series. Donna Mills, thank you so much for your time. It's been so wonderful and an honor to be able to speak with you and learn more about you.
Thank you. It was lovely to talk to you.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Donna Mills, actor, producer, and more. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Let's go now to Goldilocks. One of many sides to her music behind us. We've had her on the program in the past talking about her music, and she'll be on again in a couple of weeks. But now we'll hear how she's had to adapt during the coronavirus pandemic. Later, a glimpse behind the scenes in the world of wrestling entertainment. As a performing musician, talk to me about how COVID-19, the pandemic, has affected you and your world of performing and what you've had to do to adapt. I know some of the biggest musicians, they're doing these videos that it's just like you or any of my friends out here doing videos. They're doing their separate studio and then let's edit it all together. And it's very simple yet complex at the same time.
What's hard with that is, like, just because they're doing that doesn't mean that's helping their income at all. Like,
no.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's just such a whack time. People are doing some really great things like that, but they're also draining their bank accounts, not to be morbid, but let's just be real.
Yeah.
Draining their bank accounts and running up their credit cards. And it's just, for all of us that thought we were getting ahead, doesn't need to be a musician. That's just people in general. And then this hits, and it's just like, thanks for the $1,200, but that's not going to quite cover the overhead over 4 months. It's just really, really odd. I do photography as well, and I couldn't do that, you know, canceled all the sessions, and it just really sucked. I have an online store, so I was advertising that more. I also have a movement and a trademark, ICANCER, lowercase CER.life. That's where you can find it, where there's a lot of inspirational items that either somebody going through, I like to say, visiting the cancer neighborhood, either they're visiting the cancer neighborhood or they have a friend that is. A lot of people have been ordering items that they can give a friend, especially during the COVID. They can't have visitors. They can't have this, that. People that are going to pick out a wig now, they used to have their family members be able to come in and like at least tell them what looks good on them. Now you can't even put on a wig.
Right.
You look at a picture of a wig in an isolated booth and it's just jacked. People don't think about stuff like that, like talking with all of the hospitals. The eye cancer movement, my goal is to have these shirts folded so that all you see is I can, and then the CER is folded underneath. And
oh,
then
wow,
anybody
nice.
That's admitted. Isn't that cool? Like anybody admitted to whatever center, like that's the first thing that they see. And we had this whole thing planned where the guys and I were going to go in with all these shirts and do a 45-minute acoustic. Like everything's just like whack right now. So we can't do everything that we wanted to do, but people have been ordering the items, and that has helped
somewhat
supplement some things, at least pay off all of the items that I ordered that were sitting at the print shop. I have the Factory by Goldilocks.com.
There's the Factory Photography, the Factory by Goldilocks, Goldilocks.com, as well as GoldilocksBand.com. Starting with the Factory Photography, you click on that, and there are a ton of album covers. Is this all your photography work?
That's all my stuff. Isn't that neat? And I get people all the time that call and say they want to talk to Goldie. I'm like, you're talking to her. And they're like, no, Goldie's photographer. And I'm like, that's Goldie. And then like some person actually said to me, well, clearly a man shot all of these. Just was like, well, I'll lower my voice for you then, sir, but I'm definitely a chick. So, yeah, I shoot some really dark, edgy stuff, but a lot of people don't think a chick could do that. Isn't that funny?
That's totally cool. I didn't even look at it as having any kind of gender identification to the photography on
some
that.
Some of it's really edgy.
Yeah. The fact is if you go to simply thefactoryphotography.com, you will just see a number of CD covers, album covers. That
I
is
shoot
incredible.
Everybody.
I knew
suck.
You were a photographer.
I'm not the best photographer, but I make people feel good, so I get good pictures.
We have to separate, though, the Factory Photography from the Factory by Goldilocks. And in this case now, we're looking at T-shirt designs and quite a variety of types of T-shirts and stuff. So I have to ask, are these all your designs, or are they designs that you find and then they're funneled through
Everything
your site?
Everything is. A couple I've modified that I've seen ideas. But for the most part, I just sit in my studio and come up with things that I think are cool or funny, that are positive, that would make everything that we do as a band or even all to you is supposed to invoke some sort of light or hope or some sort of message. Like, there just isn't anything. I think that as an artist, especially one that's done a lot of the stuff that I have, I think you have a responsibility to do stuff that's going to help. My mom used to say, shit in, shit out. You know, that's what she said. And it's true. Like, what you pour into your brain and into your mind, what you watch on TV, what you look at on, you know, whatever it is, it does leave an impact. As Footprints in the Sand did, or The Giving Tree, or The Velveteen Rabbit. Like, things do make an impact, so I try to pour in some good stuff. But yeah, everything on that site is meant to make you feel better.
Yes.
Like, I don't want people going to our stuff and feeling bad. I want them to come away feeling better. And even, you know, plug real quick, Patreon. I want people to go and feel better, or a lot of dudes get some advice on how to get a lady or man or whatever they're into. You know, like, it should be empowering, educational stuff with a little bit of an edge.
I'm glad you mentioned Patreon, because I want you to explain for folks what Patreon even is. It's in essence, it's a patron for you.
Yeah, you have to pay to view content. But a lot of people that are listening, if you have a favorite artist, they might be on there, like showing them painting and then breaking it down and talking about brush strokes and like where the influence is coming from and their inspiration. And like, they might run a camera for 30 minutes and get unedited content that, if that's your favorite painter, you're going to want to see it. Your favorite musician, your podcaster, somebody who plays video games, just anybody that does something that you're interested in or create in some way, shape, or form, whether it be music or videos or art or what have you, they more than likely could be on Patreon. And my stuff is just a lot of, like, I can't keep the lights on just doing content for free every day and make a few pennies from YouTube monetization. That's not going to cut it. We're doing, like, very, very in-depth, like, Tosh.0. It's called The Daily Dump. And we just find a theme. And we find a bunch of stuff that's really funny and messed up, and we go to town on it. It's PG-13. It's nothing that I would not show my dad. But, you know, some of it does get a little bit edgy because it's funny and it's real. And you can do it on Patreon, where everybody is there because they want to see it, and they're not just going to see it on Facebook and get all offended or whatever like that. But it's really funny, And our guitarist, Serge, has been working on original content with me. And the guy, he's younger. He's a scream. He brings in a different demographic. And it's just really fun to come up with stuff. Tub Talk is on there. Tub Talk is basically Dr. Drew and Adam Carolla, well blind, but I'm in the tub. And
covered
I'm
up.
Shrinked up and pruned like and wrinkly by the time I get out of there. And it's uncomfortable, but it's just funny to have advice given from the tub. People tune in for that.
It's funny as well. And you mentioned Serge. We've been speaking about Rod Saylor. So Rod Saylor, maybe the only consistent member of the band since I've known you. What is the most current lineup? You just mentioned Serge Drobin.
That's it.
That's
we're
it.
Done. We're
it's
done. We're going to leave it at Serge and we're going to leave it at Rod. We've had 104 bass auditions from November when somebody bailed out on us and not happy about it. But, you know, you were talking earlier about revolving doors. That's how it is. It's hard to keep a band together. But I've got two really great people. We just had another audition. The guy was all ready to go, and then he just ghosted us again. So
okay.
I'm just done. I really am done with worrying about a bass player. We're just going to have bass tracks. I'm so done with flaky musicians, David Fleming. They are just atrocious. If you're a business person and an entrepreneur, you actually want to get up and do some work during the day, we can be friends. But the rest of y'all can just take a hike.
Nice. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Goldilocks. Music and more at Goldilocks.com, The Factory by Goldilocks.com, GoldilocksBand.com, as well as TheFactoryPhotography.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. We're streaming live at KVCRnews.org. Back now to Goldilocks. Just a bit ago, we heard about some of the ways she's had to adapt as a performing musician during this coronavirus pandemic. And now, another side to Goldie. I'd like to talk wrestling with you for a bit.
Let's do it.
Excellent. What I'd really like to do here is break down the roles for us. When someone is watching wrestling, and let's say a wrestling show, because two-thirds of the programming these days isn't even the wrestling, but it's the drama unfolding in front of it. So if you could break down the, you know, all I know to say is there's the good guy and the bad guy, but I know there's people like the heel and all this sort of thing.
The heel is the bad guy.
The heel is the bad guy.
Babyface is the good guy.
Babyface is the good guy or good girl, and the heel is the bad guy or the bad girl.
Yep, they're just face. That's what they call it, just face and heel.
Okay,
and there's always a heel turn where you have somebody being a face for a while, and then it's planned or it's talked about that in this month or during this time, this person's going to turn heel. Or sometimes things just organically happen. Like, a lot of people like to say wrestling isn't real, and it's like, what is real? You know, because real to me is massive injuries that people sustain on a daily basis that other people going to work at their accounting job or office are not having metal chairs smashed to their face or jumping off of a top rope or landing on concrete. So many things that happen in wrestling. You got a lot of men and women who are massively injured, and by the age 40, they can barely move
because
of all the broken bones that they've had and everything like that. You know, there are some things that are scripted and choreographed, like going through your match, but there's nothing not real about being slammed on a mat. Anybody that camps out on that, oh, it's not real, like those type of people, like if I sent you all of the photos that I have this week of people's bones protruding out of their shoulders or their elbows or their whatever, and then they just had to sew it up on the spot at some indie back alley locker room and it's all crudely bleeding and it's just, it's a mess. It's very, very real when it comes to that. Like, some things are predecided, but then people are human beings, and no matter how you think things are going to go, how they're supposed to go, they don't always go like that. Like, I actually did a match where I thought somebody was going to kill me. I mean, that's the truth. You're scared to death. You think, are they going to get out there and just kill me because they're mad? Because they can. I'm going out in the lion's den. Anything can happen.
A friend many years ago tried to get me involved, and because I have a theater background, he approached me with the idea of doing high-impact theater.
Nice.
That's how he tried to sell it to me. So the referee, then, does the ref have any behind-the-scenes role other than conveniently looking the other way when someone pulls out a razor or a chain or a folding chair or whatever?
The ref, more than likely, usually is a worker, and they're working their way into it, or they just decide, I'm going to just stay as a ref. The ref has so much knowledge and education and history and usually can help if something goes really, really wrong, you know, like almost like EMT training type thing. Their roles are so far beyond somebody looking the other way or doing like those guys, well, mostly guys, they're just amazing. And a lot of people started out as a referee, and then they knew the business, and they knew all of the rules and the moves, and then they bumped themselves up to being a wrestler or a worker, as they call it, or a jobber.
Yeah, I would
imagine.
They're
a different breed.
Now, here's another role, and that is the, quote, manager. Looking at someone like the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. Okay, that gives away a bit of an age here thing for me. But, you know, folks like him, he was the smaller Memphis scene with Jerry Lawler and folks like that, Bill Dundee and all that. The manager, again, do they serve any kind of function within the role of this televised performance, other than, again, being someone who, for the sake of the crowd, distracts one of the wrestlers while someone comes in with that folding chair once again or whatever? Is there something that we as viewers don't know about?
It's something that I never gave any second thought to growing up until I became one.
Uh-huh.
And one of the biggest wrestlers of all time. You know, like, I didn't realize, and my becoming a manager was completely by accident. I was a color commentator and backstage interviewer. Like, I had no business being a wrestler or a manager, but a comment was made on live pay-per-view TV for millions of people, and it popped. That means it went over, or people liked it. And the next time I showed up for my pay-per-view, they said, well, now you're wrestling, you're managing this guy.
Mm.
And I had to learn what the role of a manager was very quickly, and the manager's role, especially for people that, you know, like the Undertaker, like, maybe they don't talk. Percy Pringle, he was his mouthpiece, and he was this creepy, dead-looking guy. Percy Pringle told his story. So the manager, sometimes when people are mute or they don't talk or they're silent for a while, it's their responsibility and their job to tell that story. It's like the posse. There's other people that are linked. It tells the story and it makes it more impactful. And sometimes the manager gets bumped or gets hit. Sometimes they wrestle. And other times, you know, like, I'm trying to think of Bobby Heenan for years.
Oh, wow.
They become their own entities and their own characters because they're good on the mic and they can really talk. And Jimmy Hart was Hulk Hogan's manager forever and really was there as, like, that cheerleader. It's just more interesting in a production when there's just not one person. And Prince taught me that because I thought I should be the only person on stage. You know, I thought it should just be me. And he's like, no. You need to have some background dancers, and then no, you need to have a band behind you, and then no, you need to get rid of your headset and have a microphone. I didn't want to do any every time I fought on everything. No, I want to be able to dance around. How can I dance around if I have a microphone?
Yeah.
Like, well, that won't work, you know, and like, it will. Then you're going to be more like Roger Daltrey and not like Britney Spears. And I fought everything tooth and nail, but the manager brings more layers, more depth to the production.
Nice. One more thing in the wrestling world. And this, I guess, deserves a little bit of background. I had a friend who was just praising one wrestler or another. I forget who it was, and it really doesn't matter at this point. But they were talking about their love for this person and the fact that they were a great athlete, they were a great entertainer. But then they also mentioned, and they're a two-time National Wrestling Federation champion, or whatever the case is. And so, if someone is a belt holder, some sort of regional or national championship belt, that is, first, I have to say, we have to recognize the incredible athleticism it takes to do this high-impact theater. What does a championship belt even mean, beyond those who think this is real?
That's a great question. And again, all my years in wrestling, it's like, now I'm finally figuring it out. Because I was just like, well, who cares? It's just some belt. And I mean, that belt means that somehow, some way, in a testosterone-driven pool of cutthroat sports entertainment, that a unanimous vote for this person to be the belt holder was somehow achieved. That many people decided, like, yeah, this guy is... And I was watching AJ Styles, who I grew up with in our promotion. Like, we all started out on the same day. And he's a huge WWE superstar now. And I watched him at 23 years old. And obviously he's not 23 years old anymore. That was 18 years ago. And nobody's got a bad word to say about the guy. He always walked the walk, did everything he needed to do, showed his face, was true, was honest, was fair. The most amazing athlete I've ever seen. I mean, we're talking about guys that moonsault and somersault and twist and turn off of tops of cages.
Oh, yeah.
And land precisely on a dime. You know, like, where if you didn't land the right way, you would kill not only yourself, but the person you're landing on. You know, your elbow hits their windpipe wrong, or you twist in a way where your back of your head hits something and you're knocked down and you're killed. I mean, there's just every time these guys go out into the ring, they can die. I mean, you're physically just saying, I'm going to go flail my body and impale it with something. So when they get a belt and somebody decides in the office unanimously it has to be voted on, or the people do, or the community, or his peers, that's what that belt is really saying. Like, wow, this person is absolutely extraordinary. They have paid their dues. They've showed up. They've done all of this work. They've traveled cross country for $50 maybe, and then stayed and broken down that mat, put it away, and packed it up. It's like, that's what that belt is representing. It's not just some thing that somebody ordered off of a website that's shiny and new and here you go. It's representing all of the work and tolerance and acceptance that everybody has for them. And that's why it's a big deal. And when you give it away and it's time to give it to somebody else, it's like a Miss America crown, kind of like, what does that really mean? Is it just some shiny tiara? Or did that girl really do some extraordinary things, display immense talents, team building attitude, whatever you want to call it? That's what the belt is representing, something similar to that.
Cool.
A lifetime achievement award in sports or et cetera. It's not just about the trophy. It's about everything that that person has done and stands for and represents as a human. That's what they're getting. That's the belt.
So then for the wrestling fan, this would be the equivalent of a Super Bowl championship ring or whatever. But then from the other side, the folks looking at the pure entertainment side of it, this is a recognition, almost like a nod from the Academy. Not quite the Academy
exactly.
Award, but
yeah.
Recognizing the
Which
various...
Which is hard to get. I mean, you look at the people that have held the belts for the longest, or the most belts, or the most awards. They are the John Cena's. They are the Dwayne Johnson or The Rock.
Yeah, Ric Flair.
They're the people that transferred over into other media outlets. Like, they're in the movies, or they're in the this, or they're in the that. Like, if you ever listen to John Cena, like, actually speak, like, go look up the Chris Benoit interview about Chris Benoit with John Cena and Bret Hart on Larry King Live. Listen to how incredibly articulate John Cena is. I was just like, oh my God, I can't even believe this guy is a human, let alone a wrestler, and he can speak this eloquently and perfectly. I'm like, I've been doing this whole interview, like, just on his game, on his mark, and it's like, no wonder he's held so many belts, and now he's in commercials and in movies and mainstream entertainment, not just wrestling. Definitely crossed over.
Oh yeah.
Those are the people that have held the belts. The great athletes, great entertainers, great human beings, great humanitarians. I think John Cena single-handedly has gone to more children's hospitals and done the Make-A-Wish deal than all of us combined in his lifespan.
Wow.
That's just what he does. He just does that. It's not even noted, or people don't even know about it. It's just like, that's on his weekly routine of things to do.
Nice.
He's just a really, really insanely amazing human being.
Way cool.
Yeah. That, I hope that answers your question.
Totally, yeah. So what other roles have we not covered? We've got the face, we've got the heel, we talked about the referee, the manager. Other roles in the wrestling world, when someone sees a wrestling match on TV or in person, but I think especially on TV, any other roles that we have not addressed here?
I would say everybody in the office. A lot of them used to be wrestlers, and now they're retired as far as taking bumps. But like WWE, their entire back office, their entire writing crew, their entire staff is all people that have now shifted in from the physical attributes of wrestling to coming up with the psychology behind everything. And if you don't understand psychology, it's why are people doing what they're doing? Like, what story is being told? Is, you know, like Air Paris, I interviewed from WCW, who started wrestling when he was 14, with David Young, who was 17, on these major, major events, illegally wrestling. They didn't know how old he was, but they knew he was young. Therefore, they gave him the name Eric Young. And I just said, you know, how do you prepare for matches? Because he said when he would work with AJ Styles, obviously I was just talking to him, like one of the biggest people in the business, that he did all the matches, not AJ, that Eric Paris did. And I'm like, how do you even come up with matches? How do you? He's like, well, I'm a scrawny little kid. I'm tiny. So I would look at Shawn Michaels. I would look at all of these people that were my size and see, like, they always did the underdog approach to things so that people would feel sorry for him. And then at the very end, he could go in for the kill and get the win. He'd get way more sympathy and way more excitement and approval if he started out as the underdog and, like, letting himself get beat and hurt all the time. Developed this whole psychology and this whole mind game with people, and it's not by accident. It's very planned and it's very studied and pre-calculated, and things happen organically, of course, but it's like there is a studying in this business that people just think it's probably a bunch of guys running around in tights and doing their thing, and it's so much more than that.
Sure.
So the people that help say, well, that doesn't make sense if you did this, and that wouldn't make sense if this happened, and this is the right way that this should be. That's all the people in the office, and then they're looking at everything and saying, you know, this person had the belt for this many years or this many months. Now it's time to have somebody else get it. Who's the best candidate for this? And then what's that going to look like? And then, well, then the people aren't going to like that because he's a bad guy. So now we have to have another bad guy turn good or be a face. Or So it's just like a revolving soap opera and writing, just like they do at the television network that you're at. Like, it's constantly somebody's got to show up every day and figure out and predetermine how things are going to look like they should go. Again, things go awry or they just organically happen a different way, but there has to be some sort of plan in motion or it would just be complete chaos and nobody would tune in each week.
I guess the huge difference here is that your office staff is a collection of 6'3" former theater majors.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So, but like, where are they going to go when they can't work anymore, as far as like, it's not a good idea to break any more bones or their neck's permanently broken? Or
right.
The
right.
first wrestler I ever met flying from LAX to BNA was the Fallen Angel, Christopher Daniel. And he just quietly let me know, like, he had a broken neck and a broken back, and he couldn't barely sit. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, this is a huge opportunity. It's a new promotion. I'm not going to get an opportunity like this again. And I'm like, I'm like, you're going to wrestle with a broken neck and a broken back? He's like, well, yeah, because somebody else will get my spot. And I was like, wow, welcome to the wrestling business. I couldn't believe it. I remember sitting across from him in the aisle watching him suffer in pain. And that's why a lot of these guys develop pill addictions, is because you're on so many painkillers just to even do your job. I mean, you got people calling out at your regular theater major job because they've got a runny nose or a sore throat. Or imagine if you had to go to work with a broken neck, a broken back, and all this stuff, and then not just sit there in pain, but go irritate it more by jumping off the top ropes of something.
Oh,
you know, like, it's just
suddenly crazy. My hangnail doesn't seem so bad.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's crazy, crazy stuff. Like, they really have to love what they're doing.
Really cool. Moon, this is the stuff that I've always wanted to ask somebody, but didn't want to get body slammed. For this last part of KVC Arts, I've been speaking with Goldilocks in the wrestling world, the music world, and more. Find more at goldilocks.com. That's GoldilocksS.com. The Factory by goldilocks.com, goldilocksband.com, as well as thefactoryphotography.com. Goldilocks will be back in a couple of weeks with a very special song with a very special purpose. In the meantime, thanks again to Goldilocks as well as to Donna Mills. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR, it's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR1, and Google Play, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.